the non-U.S., let's say the EFA index, is down almost 30% from its peak a little bit over a year ago, and trading at 10 times earnings now. Another 15 to 20% drop, you know, we'd be trading at 8 times. That's why I'm kind of optimistic in the sense that, you know, the prices have declined already substantially to anticipate economic weakness. I mean, that's like a dream scenario for anyone who has a 3 to 5 year time horizon. My job is not to solve for the world's problems. My job is only to solve for one problem, how to make money for our investors over the next 3 to 5 years. The surest way to do that is to buy good quality businesses at low prices.
That's an edited clip of Abhay Deshpande, Chief Investment Officer at Centerstone Investors, who says the blood is running in the streets in Europe, and that's why you want to invest there. He's part of a jam-packed lineup that starts with Mark Scalzo, Chief Investment Officer at Validus Growth Investors, manager of the Destra Multi-Alternative Fund, a closed-end fund trading at a discount of more than 30%, which we'll talk about. Plus, we've got Tony Turner from Trendstar Group here talking technicals, a bonus interview with Charles Roteblatt from AAII Journal talking about bearish investors.
You're one hell of an optimist.
There's no optimism to be found. And Martin LeClaire from Barrick Yard Advisors is here talking stocks in the market call. This is Money Life for September 23rd. Oh, if I'm talking fast and sounding excited, that's because I am. We have a jam-packed show that I did something we almost never do. And I hope you are the beneficiary. Tell me what you think of it, because it's the kind of thing we do when we're away, right? When we were in FinCon, we had a show that ran almost an hour and a half. But we try to be within our normal footprint. We basically run a radio schedule most days. And while we take a little bit of leeway with that, not much. Well, we had an interesting thing occur on Thursday, which is Tony Turner was scheduled to chat with us, and she wound up missing the time. Something was going on. It was not a big deal, and we would have been happy to reschedule. So, okay, while we're uncertain of that, AAII releases the latest sentiment survey, which Charles Roteblatt is responsible for. So I sent Charles a note just in case, going, hey, might you be available to talk about this? A little while later, he comes back and says, yes, I can talk about this. And a little while later, Tony comes back and says, hey, I'm sorry I had this thing come up, but I'll be free. So what do? You take both of them. Even if you're thinking,
we don't have time for this kind of talking thing you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we may not have had time for it, but that's not meaning that we're going to do it. So not going to do it. So we have a show that's running a little bit long today because we have an extra interview. Tightened up as much as we could, kept Charles under our normal time for doing something like a Survey Said segment. But under any circumstances, we're bringing you as much as we can. So I'm going to keep this super short, but do write me, chuck@moneylifeshow.com. I mean, hey, if you love this show and wish we were longer all the time and think we should stop worrying about the timing that we keep, I don't think we're going to get to where we ever do that. We've done a lot where we're going, hey, let's do three interviews rather than four and give guys extra time. But this is a fifth interview. It's normally something we don't do unless we're on the road, and we've done it today. I'll be curious what you guys think. If it's like just that's too over the top, there's nothing that's so important it can't wait, because that's kind of what we think is that, remember, it's always, you know, don't worry too much about it. Let's go about our day and keep every day, no matter how good, high or low, every day sort of normal. That's a big part of what we do here. I'm Chuck Jaffe. You can reach me, chuck@moneylifeshow.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @ChuckJaffe. You can follow the show, @MoneyLifeShow. The benefit to doing it is when the show goes up, there's a tweet that comes out, both from me and the show site, that'll let you know that, hey, the show's up. That's the real benefit. I don't tweet much the rest of the time, though I did tweet this week about how in the weird financial news, we had Elon Musk and donkey penises mentioned in the same segment. Yeah, but beyond that, yeah, I don't tweet too much. Let's get busy because we need to jump into it. Again, Mark Scalzo, really interesting conversation about alternatives. Abhay Deshpande, really interesting conversation about international investing and valuations. Tony Turner, really interesting conversation on technicals. Charles Roteblatt, yes, investor sentiment right now is at an interesting level. And Martin LeClaire is always an interesting guy to chat with. He's here for the market call. We'll kick things off with the Navigator when we really get rolling next.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
Mark Scalzo, manager of the newly listed Destra Multi-Alternative Fund, is here. And we're talking alternative investments now in The Navigator. Welcome to The Navigator, where we talk about all-weather active investing and plotting a course to financial success with the help of closed-end funds. The Navigator is brought to you by the Active Investment Company Alliance, which is a unique industry organization representing all facets of the closed-end fund industry, from users and investors to fund sponsors and creators. If you're looking for excellence beyond indexing, The Navigator will point you in the right direction. And today we're heading in the direction of alternative investments with Mark Scalzo. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Validus Growth Investors and Portfolio Manager to the newly listed Destra Multi-Alternative Fund. Now, it's newly listed, not newly minted. The fund has been around since 2012, but just January of this year, it became listed on the New York Stock Exchange, where it trades under the ticker symbol DMA. You can learn more about the firm, Validus, at validusgrowth.com and more about the fund at destracapital.com. You can also learn more about business development companies, closed-end funds, and interval funds at AICAlliance.org, the website for the Active Investment Company Alliance. Mark Scalzo, thanks for joining me on The Navigator.
Thanks, Chuck. It's great to speak with you today.
Mark joins us on the Gainbridge Hotline. Gainbridge has embarked on a mission to create a digital platform that provides direct access to trusted annuity products without complexity or hidden fees. Learn more at gainbridge.life. Mark, I started by talking about the fact that you are newly listed. Well, there aren't a lot of new listings this year, pretty much of any type, but yours is also a little bit different. So can you talk a little bit about the evolution of the fund and what the process and what a direct listing, which is your process, actually does and means for investors?
Sure. So the fund started as a closed-end, non-listed interval fund over 10 years ago. And the idea was really to provide non-correlated income and a diversified exposure to alternatives to high net worth investors. In January, we directly listed the fund's common shares on the New York Stock Exchange, meaning that our existing shareholders continued to hold their shares, just in a different format. For comparative purposes, the more traditional way of going public in an initial public offering involves selling shares to new shareholders and raising additional capital. This is usually preceded by several months of marketing to create interest from these new investors and shareholders. But we went the direct route, Chuck.
What was the other impetus for doing this? I mean, if you weren't doing it to raise capital and, you know, take it to market, was there another impetus that said, hey, this is going to make us function better or differently?
One of the things about a closed-end interval fund structure is that you are required to do quarterly tender offers for the existing shareholders. So one of the things that makes that very difficult as a portfolio manager is that we're investing in a lot of illiquid securities in the alternative space. And that really makes it difficult to manage a portfolio when there's constant redemptions in the fund or the ability for redemption. So the listed closed-end fund structure doesn't allow for redemptions in the same way, in that if an individual shareholder wants liquidity, they just buy and sell in the open market.
Well, let's move to what it is that you do in the open market, because you're buying alternative investments and alternatives need to be defined. They mean different things to different people. And in fact, you guys and Destra have always referred to the Destra Multi-Alternative Fund as the alternative closed-end fund. So explain what you mean by alternatives and what makes you think, at least, that you're that exclusive.
For us, alternatives means being non-correlated with traditional asset classes. And so those would be equity, fixed income, traditional asset classes that investors can invest in. I guess the idea of the alternative closed-end fund is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but really with a reason. There's nothing like our fund as far as we know. From the inception of this fund, it pursued a multi-strategy, multi-asset class approach to alternative investing, really akin to what David Swensen had done at the Yale Endowment for a long time. And the fund started off in a vehicle that in many cases represented someone's entire allocation to alternatives, so we had to cover the gamut. So
this endowment methodology usually involves a broad exposure to alternative asset classes and strategies. And as I mentioned, they're not correlated with traditional asset classes. And they're not just real estate and credit strategies. It also involves having usually a healthy allocation to illiquid investments. And that provides some of the non-correlated attribute of the portfolio. Today, the fund can invest in almost anything that furthers that mandate of non-correlated income and returns for our investors. For instance, the fund will invest in public and private markets, illiquid and liquid positions across real estate, direct private equity, alternative credits, commodities, currencies, infrastructure. We can even hedge different exposures in the liquid markets in our portfolio. So we think this is a pretty unique combination of investments and a unique portfolio that places us kind of in a special position in the closed-end fund universe.
In terms of the alternatives that you were buying, help my audience understand what those are and how their performance is not correlated with the rest of the market. Because again, alternatives, you could be doing private equity, you could be doing artwork.
And we can do all those things if it made sense for our portfolio. But most of what we do requires a lot of due diligence, right? So there's a higher hurdle for assets that are illiquid or that have limited liquidity and that you're going to hold for a longer period of time, as you can imagine. So we try to leverage our capital base as creatively as we can. For instance, we've negotiated some preferred terms for certain products and strategies in situations where our capital is early in the process of establishing that strategy and where it's more meaningful to the overall success. So as you can imagine, we can get pretty attractive preferred terms in doing things like that. As an example, also recently, we've been utilizing structured notes to provide downside protection for our liquid exposure. Structured notes are really just notes that are issued by a sponsored bank like Goldman or JP Morgan, where the performance of the note is determined by some specific underlying index or basket of securities. And so we do our own bottom-up proprietary research on individual stocks. So we're leveraging that experience and that research to construct our own customized notes that have favorable risk-reward characteristics for the fund. Another interesting area that we look at is direct operating company investments, kind of our private equity exposure, but we do it directly. We look for situations with asymmetrical risk-reward where we can invest very little capital in each opportunity relative to the size of the fund, with the hope that the reward will really move the needle over time. And we look for companies that are trying to solve big problems or meet a big market need. Some of the investments we've made have focused on computer vision on the edge, DNA storage, financial education through gamification, and even children's nutrition. So those are some examples. And generally, the performance of these individual securities is not as susceptible to whatever the current sentiment in the market is. So you're allowed to rely much more on the underlying fundamentals and performance of the operating business or the strategy rather than letting sentiment kind of drive the day-to-day price movements.
I know that folks who run closed-end funds are loath to talk about discounts, but we need to talk about yours because at DMA, since the listing, you guys have not just been double-digit discounts. You've been high double-digit discounts, like in the 30% range. I'm curious, correct, without putting you in a position that managers can't discuss, what you think is driving the discount. And just out of curiosity, do you think it has anything to do with the fact that Morningstar has Destra Multi-Alternative in a category of one? In other words, you are the best fund in your category. But, oh, by the way, you're also the worst fund in your category. Does that have anything to do with this?
I certainly think it does. I mean, I think there are several factors. One you mentioned is important. It's also been a heck of a year to go public, right? 2022 has been a real challenging environment for every asset class.
And yeah, good call on that.
Many IPOs and direct listings, I think the average IPO is down something like 48% this year. So we're caught up in a little bit of that. We're this new investment vehicle that not a lot of people understand. I think that's a part of it. You know, as I mentioned before, we didn't go public the normal way, which would involve educating a bunch of new investors in terms of what the fund is and what we do and why we're unique. So we didn't have a real opportunity to sort of tell that story prior to the stock actually trading on the open market. So we've had to do that after the fact and build buyer interest after the fact. And so that's been a little bit different. Also, something I would point out is that before we listed the fund, we had to turn off, because of the listing, we had to turn off the tender process that I mentioned earlier, which was the way for existing shareholders to get liquidity. And as a result, there was a little bit of pent-up demand once the shares were available to trade by that existing investor base, really just as a part of the normal course of what their the advisors for these clients do in managing their exposure for those clients. So that was also a factor. And then finally, coming back to your point about the uniqueness of our fund, and there's really no comparable peer group, unfortunately. There's no easy and quick benchmark to utilize to get a sense of what the opportunity is for our fund. I don't need to tell you this, but most closed-end funds are single asset class or single strategy, most focused on delivering high yield or exclusively creating NAV growth, but not both, like our fund. So all of that makes them easier to understand and easier to benchmark, utilizing more simplistic metrics. So those simplistic metrics really miss the mark unless you're kind of willing to do the extra work to try to understand what our fund is. That said, we've seen a really interesting uptick in the volume that have been traded in our shares since February. February was roughly about 9,800 shares a day, and in August it was almost 25,000. So we've seen an interesting uptick, and the fund has performed very well this year. As of the end of last week, it was roughly, on a NAV basis, down 2.4%, and closed-end funds broadly were down about 14% on the same basis. So I think all of those factors have had an impact, but I think as long as we continue to demonstrate that we can deliver performance on a NAV basis, I think eventually the discount will take care of itself.
Really, really interesting, Mark. Thanks so much for joining me to talk about it.
Chuck, it was great. Real pleasure to be on your show. Thanks.
That was Mark Scalzo, the Chief Investment Officer at Validus Growth Investors and Portfolio Manager for the Destra Multi-Alternative Fund, which trades on the New York Stock Exchange under ticker symbol DMA. Learn more about the firm at validusgrowth.com and about the fund at destracapital.com. To learn more about business development companies, interval funds, and closed-end funds, check out AICalliance.org, the website for the Active Investment Company Alliance, on Facebook and LinkedIn at AIC Alliance. Later, we'll talk technicals with Tony Turner of Trendstar and much more. But next, it's the big interview with Abbe Deshpande from Centerstone Investors.
Annuities don't have to be complex. With the Gainbridge platform, you make a commitment of time for money by choosing an investment period that works for you and locking in a guaranteed fixed rate. Simple. Learn more at Gainbridge.life.
It's time for the big interview on the September 23rd edition of Money Life. Joining me now, Abbe Deshpande. He is founder and chief investment officer at Centerstone Investors, manager of the Centerstone Investors Fund, that's C-E-N-T-X, Centerstone International, C-I-N-T-X, and you can learn more about both of those funds by going to CenterstoneInv.com. Abbe Deshpande, welcome back to Money Life.
Hi, Chuck. Thanks for having me.
Guests on Money Life, join us via the Gainbridge hotline. Annuities don't have to be complex. With the Gainbridge platform, you make a commitment of time for money by choosing an investment period that works for you and locking in a guaranteed fixed rate. Simple. Learn more at Gainbridge.life. Abbe, I'm really happy that we've got you on the show because while we're always going to talk big issues and big picture with you, you are somebody who is also very much focused on, you know, hey, what do I want to invest in? Where do I want to be? So we're living through these times that everybody wants to say, oh, we haven't seen him in forever. We haven't done anything. It doesn't really change what you do as an investor, does it? I mean, it may change where you look, but the basic process, how much you sell, where you tilt, any of those other things, well, no matter what you tell me you're going to see for the economy, your process hasn't changed, has it?
No. And, you know, you can just substitute Ukraine war or COVID for just the word crisis. And over 30 years that I've been doing this, it's been one crisis after another. I mean, you think about the housing busts and financial crisis, the Asian blow up, the Japanese stock market peak, China coming in and out. It's always something different. You know, history rhymes, doesn't repeat. But the process that we have, the margin of safety intrinsic value process that we use and most value investors use, we use a Centerstone, and it's been something that's evolved over time to take account of changes, but these are, you know, transitions and changes that occur over a period of time. For instance, the transition to the digital world. That evolution has kept us ahead of the game as far as how the business environment has changed over the years. And then the margin of safety intrinsic value format has allowed us to, you know, not get too aggressive at stock market highs, to become more aggressive, you know, sort of counterintuitively behave sort of against the cycle in some ways. And that has not changed. And that's something that, you know, we use to navigate a very uncertain world with constant challenges thrown at us, you know, including what's going on these days.
So let's talk about what's going on these days. We saw the Fed. It did exactly what we expected it to do. It then telegraphed what it expects next. The market isn't in love with any of this stuff. But in your general opinion, are we closer to the end of these troubles or are we still closer to the beginning? We've got a long way to go.
I think maybe in price decline terms, we're closer to the end than the beginning. However, time-wise, I mean, we're anticipating recession, or I should say the world is. I'm not even sure if that's a debate yet. It's just a matter of when it happens and how severe it will be. But that uncertainty can last until you see the recession in front of you. That means unemployment rates going up and more the kind of sentiment that FedEx expressed a few days ago, Microsoft is sort of hinting at. Words like skid marks and brick wall, once that starts to populate the narrative from these larger companies throughout the rest of the year and early next year, I think that'll mark sort of a good time to start, you know, getting more optimistic about the future. That's counterintuitive, of course, but stock markets will often discount well in advance, as you know, as people who listen to the show know. But having said that, you know, Centerstone, we specialize globally, right? On global markets. We're not just U.S. In fact, the bulk of our investments now in our global investors fund are non-U.S., and that's primarily driven by the price declines that you see overseas. The non-U.S., let's say the EFA index, is down almost 30% from its peak a little bit over a year ago, and trading at 10 times earnings now. Another 15 to 20% drop, you know, we'd be trading at 8 times. When I say earnings, I mean like a normalized earnings. I'm accounting for the fact that there could be recession, but looking through that. And so that's why I'm kind of optimistic in the sense that, you know, the prices have declined already substantially to anticipate economic weakness. You know, if 15-20% drop, still a lot, but that would be, I mean, that's like a dream scenario for anyone who has a 3 to 5 year time horizon. You know, my job is not to solve for the world's problems. My job is only to solve for one problem: how to make money for our investors over the next 3 to 5 years. The surest way to do that is to buy good quality businesses at low prices, and you're in that zone. Now, it could get worse price-wise, but you're in that zone where it's worth thinking, if you don't have non-U.S. exposure and you're heavily weighted to the U.S., welcome to one side of the boat, right? So it's time to think about allocating more and more internationally in the face of all this terrible news that's coming out, because that's when you get the best prices, when the blood is in the street, so to speak.
How bloody is it going to get while you're, you know, going through and collecting the pennies that are there?
That is a great question, and it's also the one question I can't answer. I have no idea. No one really knows.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on the show.
Exactly. Hopefully that was helpful. But you know, so how we solve for that, of course, is we don't try to estimate what the downside is. We're trying to account for a business's ability to handle a downside, meaning a balance sheet, you know, a business model that can survive fluctuations in the economic cycle. But really what we're trying to do is look at what the business can earn over a normal cycle and then look at valuation compared to that. That gets us through this kind of debate whether or not it's going to be bloody or sort of bloody or what have you, and allows us to then focus on really things that matter, which are like the drivers of the business's intrinsic value over a period of time rather than over 6 months. Recessions, the economic downturns, you know, they will never be outlawed, right? They're a part of the economic landscape. The only way I've figured out how to manage through, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, the only way I've been able to manage through all of these different challenges and, you know, different crises or what have you, is to do exactly what I'm describing. You know, don't pay attention to the short term, forget about the news, look at the fundamentals, and hold on. Don't panic when the news is, that's why I say ignore the news, when the news is as bad as it is. And that gets you through really tough times intact. And if you can focus more on those you know, for instance, in Europe or even really outside the United States, almost this is a blanket statement, but everything's fairly is undervalued. And you don't even have to go through the struggle of, oh, should I do growth or value? It's like irrelevant right now. You can buy value funds like ours that have growth companies and high value companies in them because you can buy those things at value prices. And so, you know, you can be somewhat indiscriminate when you get exposure to non-U.S. markets in periods like this, whether it's developed or non-developed. That's using this kind of approach that we have. And I encourage people to stick with this kind of approach because it works. It's the only one that I know that's worked over long periods of time.
The phrase there, you can be kind of indiscriminate. Wow. Because as a general rule, what we hear from most managers, and again, you're not most managers. That's part of why we're talking, is no, in times like this, you know, I hate the phrase, it's a stock picker's market, but that's what always gets thrown out there. I hate it because it's always a stock picker's market. When is good stock picking terrible? But again,
that's important. So the stock picking part of it, which is, you know, when I say indiscriminate, I mean within the parameters that we've established, like the business has to have a good balance sheet. It has to have a management team that's shareholder friendly. And it has to have a business model that's not getting eviscerated by whatever new technology and so on. You know, provided those conditions are met, yes, you can be fairly aggressive. You just might have to close your eyes for 5-6 months. But, you know, the pricing is quite attractive.
You know, the thing that doesn't get as much press right now is the strong dollar and what that's doing. For you, how big a factor is that as you're evaluating companies right now and evaluating the economy and what's likely to happen?
Well, I mean, the dollar where it is you know, if financial conditions can sort of stabilize, and maybe that happens middle of next year, the dollar's where it is right now, the strength actually plays very well into turbocharging whatever recovery there's going to be overseas. And it will be the opposite for U.S. companies. As the economic sort of weakness begins to proliferate, that strong dollar acts as a pretty severe headwind to just translated earnings. So in that sense, you know, it's a good setup. Right now we're half hedged on the currencies for, you know, a variety of reasons. But at some point that'll become zero hedge. But over time, you know, currencies over time wash out. And one could argue that the dollar is fairly overvalued, or the counterpart of that is foreign currencies are undervalued. Europe in particular is about 25% undervalued by now. And the pound as well is extremely undervalued. The yen is extremely undervalued. The Nordic currencies are all extremely undervalued. You can kind of go from a range of, you know, modestly undervalued to extremely overvalued. For value investors overseas, you get two things then. You get stocks that are trading at 10 times earnings, and maybe if they go lower, you know, 7-8 times earnings. You get high dividend yields of close to 4% on just the average stock, and you get the cheap currency as well. Three things are working in your favor if you have a 3 to 5 year time horizon.
Well, we love the fact that we get a chance to find out what is working in our favor. I wish we had more time to talk about it. We don't, but let's watch how it plays out and let's plan to chat again in 2023. Thanks so much for joining me, Abbe. I look forward to the next conversation already.
Thanks, Chuck. See you.
That's Abbe Deshpande. He's the founder and chief investment officer at Centerstone Investors. The Centerstone Investors Fund is CENTX, Centerstone International Fund, CINTX. Learn more at CenterstoneInv.com. We're halfway in, a little past halfway in today's show. More Money Life to come. Talking technicals next.
There's $10.6 trillion worth of assets benchmarked to Russell Indexes. It's the index family institutional investors rely on. Russell Indexes. Your index matters. See how at FTSERussell.com.
Don't get technical with me.
But enough of my technical mumbo jumbo. Allow me to demonstrate.
Well, we always want to have people demonstrating what they know about the market through technical analysis. And I'm joined by somebody who I love talking technicals with. Her name is Toni Turner. She is president of the Trendstar Trading Group. You can learn more about her at TonyTurner.com. And if you go there, you will learn, among other things, about her books. A Beginner's Guide to Short-Term Trading, A Beginner's Guide to Day Trading Online, both out in their second edition, and Invest to Win. So again, you can get more at TonyTurner.com. Tony, by the way, with an I. Toni Turner, great to have you back on Money Life.
Thanks, Chuck. Great to be here.
Tony is here on the Gainbridge Hotline. Are you searching for flexibility in your annuity products? Starting in the second year of your annuity contract, you may withdraw up to 10% of your account value each year without penalty. It's another way Gainbridge puts you in control of your financial future. Gain access, gain control, Gainbridge. Visit gainbridge.life to get started. Tony, as we get started, well, the market has had a lot to react to. Some would say we've now seen another leg down. So are we getting to where we're going to see a bottom in at any point?
Boy, I sure hope so, Chuck. I sure hope so. If you look at the SPY, which is, of course, the exchange-traded fund that follows the S&P 500 index, and that's easy to bring up on your screen. If you look at the SPY, it made its all-time high in January at about 478. And today, Thursday, right now it's trading at 374. So it's 22% off of its all-time highs. And, of course, that's in bear market territory. And we've had a lot of anguish here. But with the Fed raising interest rates and planning to do it more, that's certainly an irritant to the stock market because, of course, interest rates basically run the world. It's the cost of money, and the cost of money, we can say, runs the world. So right now, with the SPY at 374, we're looking at the very, very, very important support low in June, and it was and still is at 362. Anybody who's bullish really wants the SPY to stay above this 362 level.
What happens if we get there? If we break through 362 on the SPY, are we ripping our hair out at that point? How ugly does it get if we breach that level?
If I knew that, I would be on my yacht in the Mediterranean. I have heard people on CNBC and the networks all day long saying, this is what's going to happen and that's what's going to happen. Chuck, I've been in the market for over 25 years. Nobody on the planet knows where the market is going next. So do you rip your hair out or do you start buying? And there's an argument for both of those cases. A lot of it has to do, people forget about their own time horizon. Like if you're 60, 70 years old, what's your time horizon for your investments? You got to think about that. If you're 20 years old and the market's falling like a stone, who cares? You know, it has an upside bias. That's the good news. It has an upside bias. And it could bounce off that 362 or right near that range. And certainly I could see now it's the SPY is oversold on the 14-day RSI, which I know that doesn't impress a lot of people, but it's an important marker there. And so if it's oversold, the odds are that at least in the short term, it could bounce a little bit within the next few points. If it goes below 362, then we've got to sit and stare at it and see where the next low hits.
Let's point out, if it gets to 362, it will be much closer to the level, you know, you talked about the 22% bear market decline. Getting down to 362, adding that additional decline, puts us a little closer to what you'd expect if we had bear market with recessionary conditions, which even if it hasn't been declared yet, let's pretty much be honest, we think we have a bear market with a recession right now.
Yeah, right. We're going into earnings season, third quarter earnings season. September is always hairy anyway. Goodness knows we've got everything else on the plate here. Some of the good news seasonally is that in an election year, the market usually goes up. We'll see what happens, you know, 2023. So there could be a bounce here. I worry about people who say, I'm going to buy everything on the next bounce. And that has always worried me because maybe that works and maybe you kind of wish you'd stuck it out a little longer. And nobody on the planet knows where the market's going next.
Since nobody knows, and since you can make a case in both directions, do you do any sort of a split strategy? Are you just keeping powder dry? Are you using options as insurance for the money that you want to put to work? What's the right way to put it in with some semblance of I'm not just throwing it into a wishing well?
Certainly the paths you said are fine. What I've done is I've wandered into commodities because it doesn't take rocket science. I go to the grocery store. A loaf of bread is a heck of a lot more money than it used to be. So I look at the ETF wheat, W-E-A-T, and I say, well, we all know the price is of food are going up. This is not rocket science. And so I've wandered into wheat and corn, and I'm looking at oil because I think that may bounce again, and I'm keeping quite a bit of powder dry. And then looking at some companies that I like, and I'm holding off to see where the bottom is. There's an advantage to knowing how to read charts, at least in a very basic manner, because then you've got a picture as well as the words, I call it. You know, the fundamentals are the words and the chart is the picture. So the chart is a help, even if it's the simplest chart of all. I saw something I'll tell you real quick. I was looking at a long-term chart, which I like to do, and I was looking at a monthly chart of the SPY, the S&P Spider. It's the simplest thing to do. Your grandkids can do it. You look at the chart, know that when price is going up like it has been since 2009, basically hitting that bottom that it hit and then starting up, when it's moving up on a monthly chart in a 45-degree angle or even a little shallower, that's nice. That's sustainable. Then when we look at it, when it hit the lows in 2020, then it shot nearly straight up. When you see an angle that's parabolic and headed for the moon, it is not sustainable. And I don't care what it is. It is not sustainable. And that's what we've had. We've had a straight up, not straight up, but a pretty steep shot higher. And that is not sustainable. People like me take profits. I mean, you know. So there's some simple things you can look at on a chart that will tell you, yeah, maybe I should take a few profits here. Or it goes down really steep. Maybe it's going to bounce then, and that's a good time to get in.
We have certainly seen it bouncing around. Thanks for helping give us some idea of the fact that although it could go either way from here, maybe how we want to play it. Tony, always great to chat with you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Chuck.
That's Tony Turner, president of Trendstar Trading Group, author of Invest to Win. Or if you're looking for guides, well, how about A Beginner's Guide to Short-Term Trading or A Beginner's Guide to Day Trading Online, both out in their second edition. Get more information about Tony at TonyTurner.com and on Twitter at TonyTurnerTrade. A bonus survey said with Charles Ropeblatt from AAII is coming up. Stick with us.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
Now let's take a quick look at what the survey said. It's the Survey Said on Money Life, where we look at surveys, studies, polls, and much more to find out how people are feeling, what they're thinking, and what they're doing when it comes to money. And today we are talking about the latest AAII sentiment survey just out on Thursday. And we're doing that with Charles Ropeblatt, editor of AAII Journal, the author of Better Good Than Lucky, the guy who's been on this show as a guest more than anyone else. And if you want to learn more about what he does, it's AAII.com/sentiment survey to get to the results of their sentiment survey, which is widely quoted. And Charles is on Twitter at Charles R A A I I. But right now he's back on Money Life. Charles, always great to chat with you.
Great to talk with you as well.
Charles joins me via the Gainbridge hotline with a simple built-in calculator. The Gainbridge platform illustrates what your investment amount will return long before you make a commitment. Gain access, gain control, Gainbridge. Charles, highest level of pessimism since what some people call the great financial crisis, what I call the horrible financial crisis, but since March of 2009. Of course, that also became the time when the market turned around. So do investors have it right to be pessimistic, or is this a sign that, like, this level of pessimism means, hang on, the turnaround has come?
Usually it happens near market bottoms. And it's interesting because right now a lot of people are focused on this week's press conference from Jerome Powell, where he basically said, I'm going to keep raising rates till I see the job market really get in line with supply and demand. And there's currently no cap on rate hikes. What's interesting is I did actually look at when did we previously have higher bearish sentiment. And there's only been really four since 1987 where we've had bearish sentiment at this level or higher. Two of those were during the financial crisis. The other two were in August and October 1990. What happened then? We had the first Gulf War, worries about oil supply, shipping lanes potentially being blocked in the Middle East. What do we have now?
a war in Ukraine where we have oil being disrupted. So you do have that parallel going on there. But what we tend to see is pessimism tends to reach a peak near market bottom. Now, I'm not saying we've hit the market bottom. There are some questions now about if the Fed's going to continue raising, whether or not the market could actually fall lower than it previously has. That's potentially a possibility. On the flip side is if we look past the rate tightening cycle, we could be looking at a situation where maybe job demand gets more in line. But the other hand, we could start seeing all these supply chain issues even out. And even Fed Chairman Powell acknowledges an improving supply chain would help things out, although he has no control over it. So figure something happens between Russia and Ukraine, helps energy prices drop, look at supply chain possibly getting better. Then maybe you have some things that are dragging down the rate of inflation that perhaps slows inflation enough that gives CEOs and the market more confidence. And then maybe we do get a rise in stocks. Now, when does that occur? I'll tell you after the fact. I certainly can't predict it.
And that's the interesting thing to me out of the numbers, because on the one hand, it's the highest level of pessimism since March of 2009, which rings the bell with me because, of course, that's when the market bottomed out. But let's point out, bullish sentiment below its historical average for almost a full year now. Unusually low for the last month and for most of this year. So if investors were going to be like, hey, we're the contra indicator when we're really bullish, good things will happen. Well, they haven't proven that yet this year. They just happen to kind of reach a benchmark area of pessimism now.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I had to look at the numbers today for like the Investors Intelligence Survey of investment newsletters. Well, we've seen the newsletter writer survey earlier this year. We've seen Bank of America's survey of investment managers. Those have earlier this year shown really low levels of optimism as well. So we are seeing pessimism elsewhere in the markets. So it's not just individual investors, but it is worth noting that bullish sentiment this week ranks in the 20th lowest of all those weeks since 1987. So roughly 1,750 weeks, and this is in the bottom 20. So it's an old adage of buy when there's blood in the streets, but really what we've seen is you want to buy when everyone else is really fearful. So it's hard to necessarily call a market bottom, but when you see sentiment being really low, it is a sign that maybe you should stop, take a look around, and ask yourself what else is going on. And one of the things we do see, if we look at valuations now relative to 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, and looking over those averages, valuations are way down. You could also look at that and say, well, at some point the market's going to turn around because valuations are lower, everyone's pessimistic. And with the supply chain, the ingredients, you can see where they're at. It's only a question of when does that cake actually get baked versus just seeing the ingredients lying there on the table.
Basically, if you're looking to buy when people are fearful, they're clearly fearful now. That's what the numbers say. Charles, thanks so much for joining me to talk about it.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's Charles Roteblatt, the editor of AAII Journal, vice president of the American Association of Individual Investors. Go to AAII.com/sentiment survey to see what sentiment's been doing, and follow Charles on Twitter. He's at Charles R. AAII. The Market Call is next. Martin LeClaire from Barrick Yard Advisors is here talking stocks when we come back in just a moment.
Annuities don't have to be complex. With the Gainbridge platform, you make a commitment of time for money by choosing an investment period that works for you and locking in a guaranteed fixed rate. Simple. Learn more at Gainbridge.life.
Martin LeClaire, Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager for Barrick Yard Advisors, is here. We're talking stocks, and this is the Money Life Market Call. Welcome to The Market Call, the part of the show where we talk with experienced money managers about how they do their job, what they look for that determines their buys and sells, what they see happening on the market, and how they're putting it all together. And my guest, well, he's particularly interested because while he's watching what's happening in the market, he's not necessarily reacting to it at all. He'll explain how it works. His name is Martin LeClaire. He's Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager at Barrick Yard Advisors. Barrack, B-A-R-R-A-C-K. Why did I spell it? BarrackYard.com is the website, and on Twitter, at BarrackYard. Marty LeClaire, it's great to have you back on Money Life.
Hey, Chuck, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Guests on Money Life appear on the Gainbridge Hotline. Gainbridge believes that deferred fixed annuities are a steady, guaranteed way to grow savings. Its innovative, self-managed digital platform provides direct access to trusted annuity products without complexity or hidden fees. Learn more at gainbridge.life. Marty, we always start with methodology, and I hinted at your methodology, that you are not going to be the guy who comes on and says, you know, hey, look what the Fed did yesterday, and, you know, what they're planning to do, and here's how we're going to change the portfolio. That's not it for you. But explain what that is it.
Well, that's right, Chuck. I see that all as being kind of noise. I guess in the big picture thing, we look at two things. One is we think through where we are in history, because financial markets are driven by human sentiment. Human nature doesn't change. So there are long-term patterns. Your listeners should think, we don't repeat the mistakes of our parents, but we repeat the mistakes of our grandparents. Along those lines, I continue to believe, as I articulated in a major article back in February of 21, that we are in the mother of all bubbles, and the bubble is starting to deflate, but it's not over. The deflation process could take many years to play out, or then again, it could happen overnight. You just don't know. So the conclusion is as I have been pounding the table for the past year and a half, is continue to live outside the bubble. Back then, 18 months ago, I said bonds are a no-go area. And of course, the bond market's down something like 25, 27% this year, off even more from their highs. To me, 3 to 5 year corporate bonds are starting to look attractive, but I still have long-term bonds as a no-go area. The second thing, based on that analysis, is that stock market indexes are continued to be priced at levels which we believe indicate disappointing returns for a long time. Our conclusion is to select in terms of owning equities to curate your portfolio, to own a selection of reasonably valued businesses is the way to go. The second big thing in terms of the big picture is that we're always thinking about what we call the Archimedean point, which is a philosophical term, but basically it's the fulcrum on which everything rests. And today it is inflation and the long-term credit cycle. We argue that both inflation and the long-term credit cycle are not our long-term friends. The markets are currently priced as if inflation is going to go back to where we were prior to the pandemic, during the great disinflation that has culminated after 40 years. We recognize, I fully admit, that after World War I and the Spanish flu pandemic, we had massive inflation in the United States, and quickly that massive inflation was reversed, and we had a period of disinflation, which unfortunately led to the Great Depression, but we had some good times before that. However, there's a narrative out there that interest rates alone can kill inflation. I believe in the narrative, which is that, yeah, Paul Volcker was amazing. However, there are two other non-repeatable historical events is why we had disinflation, and they're not going to happen again. One is the collapse of the Soviet Union, which means for a generation we've had low commodity prices in real terms. The second non-repeatable event is literally billions of people joining the global workforce. And that's been incredibly disinflationary. I could explain why, but we don't have time today. Basically, China and India opening up is not going to happen again. So where we are today is that I believe that investors cannot assume we're going to go back to 2% inflation. It could happen, but that's not my base case assumption. And if that's the assumption, there's no way I think you can be bullish in here.
When you are not able to be bullish in here, that doesn't mean you're going to cash, because that's not who you are. So what stands out? What characteristics do your buys, or maybe more importantly, your holds, because you're not necessarily changing your strategy, but you're sticking with what works. What characteristics must they have? And maybe what's a poster child for the methodology?
What you're asking me about is security selection. And there are basically four quick points I'd like to make. First of all, show me the cash. The first thing we always look at is, any business, any asset generates cash. If it doesn't generate cash, then it's a speculation. So we always think through how much you're paying relative to that cash, and what's the likelihood of that cash continuing into the future and growing. Second thing is, show me skin in the game. We like management teams that have a lot of ownership in the businesses that we also are invested in. The third thing is we have a mindset of a business owner. So we don't really care about the stock market in a sense. We care about the longevity and the growth prospects of the businesses we own. And then fourthly, we're long-term oriented. That's why I say everything that the financial press is really concerned about right now is just noise, because Einstein was right, whether he said it or not, that compounding works like magic, but it can only work if you give it time. So in terms of current strategy, we're assuming we're heading into a financial winter, number one. Number two, we are recommending that our clients have a larger than normal amount of liquidity. Number three, if I would say to your listeners, if they need to own bonds, don't own bond funds, and keep your maturities less than 7 years, preferably somewhere around 5 years. And then for income, we recommend in what I own, and every company I'm going to mention, I just want to say that I personally own as well my clients, cheap yield stocks like pipeline operators, Kinder Morgan, or Enterprise Products. Enterprise Products is a very unique, high-quality investment opportunity, but only for taxable investors who understand the master limited partnership, which trades on the exchange. Also, for income, we also like domestic-only value stocks like National Presto or Nuvera, which is a small Minnesota-based rural telecoms company, which has a lot of congressional financing in its industry as a tailwind. The second thing is, conceptually, is that we like to own companies that could benefit from inflation, because it's not good enough just to say, okay, well, this is a company that has pricing power. They can raise their prices. Most companies also have input cost inflation that they're subject to, and eventually companies are going to be squeezed in terms of consumers are going to rebel, and they can only raise prices for so long. Eventually, it's going to come out of profitability in terms of not being able to pass it on to the consumer. So that means we like, and I personally, again, own royalty models. For example, in pharmaceuticals, there's a company called Royalty Pharma. In precious metals, Franco Nevada is the quality name. They have no leverage. It's just an incredible business. Even though the price of gold over the past 10 years has been flat, it's acted like a growth stock. In finance, exchange operators like the CBOE. In industrial metals, and long-term industrial metals is a great place to be, because the transition to decarbonization is going to require a lot of stuff being taken out of the ground. But you have to be careful owning the operators. If you've done so in 1970, even though commodities quadrupled by 1980, the stocks didn't do very well, because what happens is business people, when times are good, they tend to overinvest, and then bad things happen in terms of finances. So an example of industrial metals would be Mesabi Trust, which I know sounds like a Japanese restaurant item. However, it's a royalty trust up in Minnesota, and they supply iron ore, and Cleveland Cliffs is contractually obliged to buy all their iron ore. So they have no operational risk.
What makes you move away from something? What's something you had to move away from recently?
18 months ago, one of the things I was pounding the table is to own, by 2030, I said, human beings are still going to be eating. And so I was pretty bullish on Kellogg and Nestle and Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, these packaged food companies. There are two things. One is they're extremely expensive now. They're trading anywhere around 25 times earnings. I think they should be trading more like 15 or 16 times earnings. And then number two, I think they're going to be victims of input costs. They can only increase prices for so long. And once the consumer rebels, their profit margins, which are historically very high right now, are going to be squeezed. So that's an area which I've been taking profits and raising liquidity in.
Well, now we're going to get your quick and dirty take on some stocks that my audience is particularly interested in.
Quick
and dirty.
Always account for variable change.
We are accounting for variable change today as we look at the market with Martin LeClaire, Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager at Barrick Yard Advisors. Go to barrickyard.com for more information. Quick and Dirty, of course, is where we put our guests to your test. If you want to test them yourself, you need to send your name, your hometown, and the ticker symbols you're interested in to chuck@moneylifeshow.com. We start today with two requests from Richard in Chula Vista, California. The first is Colgate-Palmolive, which is ticker symbol CL. Does it suffer the same fate as some of those other consumer? I mean, you don't necessarily eat your toothpaste, unlike Kellogg and Coca-Cola.
Colgate is a poster child for exactly what I'm talking about. It's a company that has had all the tailwinds at its back over the past decade or so. Even with that, they've only been able to grow their earnings like 2 or 3% a year, and it's trading a multiple in the high 20s. It's too rich for my blood.
It's a sell on Colgate-Palmolive.
Don't get greedy.
Yep, don't get greedy on CL. Richard's other request, Federal Realty Investment Trust, ticker FRT.
I know this company very well. They're actually located about 5 miles from my house. They are the highest quality real estate trust in the United States. They have a great management team. They've increased their dividend every year. I believe that the narrative that real estate is an inflation hedge is a bit wrong in the sense that, yeah, it might be. However, interest rates necessarily will have to go up if that's the case long term. So that's going to be a headwind for Federal. I believe that if you want to own real estate in a publicly traded entity, right now the dividend yield is like 4.7. Just pick a price and the yield you'd be happy with, knowing the dividend probably will be 50% higher in 10 years from now. So it's a good, stable, investment grade company. I have no objectives to owning it. I personally will probably start buying it at a lower price.
So it's a hold at this point, waiting for that better price.
I'm just taking my time before making the move.
Precisely, on FRT, Federal Realty Investment Trust. Steven in Flower Mound, Texas, wants to know about CACI International. It's ticker CACI.
Again, I personally own CACI. It fits the environment that I mentioned. CACI is a premier mid-cap defense contractor in the cybersecurity high-tech area. They're IT consultants. Unlike Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics, there's not a lot of concern in terms of input costs going up in an inflationary environment. So I think CACI, although it doesn't pay a dividend, but it's only trading like 14, 15 times earnings, I think it's exact poster child of the kind of company you want to own, particularly if you're bullish on defense as I am.
It's a buy on CACI International. Ticker CACI.
Would you mind stepping aside? I've got a purchase to make.
Dave in Jacksonville, Florida wants to know about GHC, Graham Holdings.
GHC, again, is a core holding of ours, mine personally. They're a local DC-based company. They are the premier for-profit education firm. They're Class Act. It's a holding company that is investing the wealth of the Graham family. And the Graham family has in their DNA great capital allocation skills because Warren Buffett served on the board of the Washington Post Company, which is what morphed into Graham Holdings. Now, Graham Holdings had a spinoff about 6-7 years ago so that it doesn't look good if you're doing screening. However, if you had bought Graham Holdings and held both the spinoff company and Graham Holdings over the past 10 years, it's grown at double-digit rates. So they're great capital allocators. I think the intrinsic value of the stock now is probably about $900. Everyone involved in the company is high class. I just think it's one of these stocks you buy and put away and don't think about again.
Graham Holdings, GHC, it's a buy.
I'm getting an education.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what they're doing. That's one reason why you want to buy. And a company that we are absolutely familiar with, Morris in Bradenton, Florida, ends us with Walt Disney Company, ticker DIS.
I owned Disney, and actually that's another example of a stock I've sold, but for a different reason, although maybe they won't be the best inflation hedge. The problem with Disney is the streaming wars. You know, the pandemic came and they had to omit the dividend. It was like, okay, you know, you got to cut them some slack for that. It's not their fault. You have these incredible assets. But the most bullish brokerage firm out there that has a buy on the stock, they're not looking for Disney to be free cash flow positive until somewhere around 2025. So this in streaming wars is going to be enormously expensive, and we don't know how it's going to play out. It doesn't pay a dividend. I don't own it anymore, and I've sold the last bit of it literally actually today.
It's a sell on Disney, ticker symbol D-I-S.
Oh, boy, that sounded bad.
It did sound bad, but what sounded great was the advice we got from Martin LeClaire. Marty, it's always great to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll do this again soon.
Anytime, Chuck. I love doing it. Thank you.
Martin LeClaire is the Chief Investment Officer, Portfolio Manager at Barrick Yard Advisors. Online at BarrickYard.com, on Twitter at Barrick Yard. We'll be back to wrap up this week on Money Life, tell you where Marty agreed or disagreed with folks, and let you know what is coming next week before we cross the finish line for the weekend.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors, Incorporated.
So it's another week already.
Hard to believe, but yes, it is. In fact, we're getting near the end of September. How is this possible? Time flies when you're having fun. Time flew today. I want to point out a couple of things quickly because we are way tight against time. Abbé Deshpande and Charles Roteblood both talked about wanting to buy when the blood is in the street, with Abbé talking more about international markets. By the way, Tony Turner didn't necessarily use that phrase, but she did talk about having a long-term time horizon and buying when things look dark, and how investors there might think longer term, which also, by the way, kind of coincides with Marty. So although not everybody said it, you did have the crossover and the takeaway about blood running in the streets. Yeah, when people keep using that analogy, maybe that's because that's what we're feeling right now. Crossover in terms of Martin LeClaire. Prior to Quick and Dirty, he mentioned Coca-Cola, which I have to say is in my own portfolio, and he was taking his profits on it. Hank Smith of Haverford Trust was buying it on March 24th. We go back 6 months. That's as far back as we go. Basically, it was one day less. So Hank Smith was buying it back then. Then we got into Quick and Dirty, where there was not any crossover till we got to Disney, which was a sell. And in my head, I thought, sell, that was not that common on Disney because we'd had folks that liked it. But the truth is, in the last 6 months, no, no, no. Chance Finucane of Oxbow Advisors, he was selling it in early August, a day after Bill Smead from Smead Value was selling it. Now, Ed Schill of the Wealth Enhancement Group was buying it back on June the 2nd, but Hank Smith, again from Haverford Trust, again March 24th, fully 6 months ago, said he had sold it due to the dividend cut. The dividend cut was where Marty was a little bit less concerned about the dividend cut, was looking at other things. Hank was all about the dividend cut. Next week on this show, just a quick taste, Jason Thomas, chief economist at Portfolio Design Labs, Kevin Mann from Hennian & Walsh, Meb Faber from Cambria Investments. Actually, I think Meb's the following week. Andrew Graham from Jackson Square Capital, Chris Armbruster from Kane Rudnick, Alexander Spencer from Bogart Wealth will all be here doing market calls with Alexander talking about ETFs and funds. And Jim Welsh will be here talking technicals from MacroTides and the Weekly Technical Review. If you are looking for something to celebrate today,
it's party time.
It's National Great American Pot Pie Day and National Snack Stick Day. It is Restless Legs Awareness Day. If you've got restless legs, you're pretty much aware of it whenever they're restless. And by the way, Saturday is National Cherries Jubilee Day, something worth celebrating, and also National Punctuation Day. We should celebrate punctuation every day. And Sunday is National Lobster Day. I don't know if that means you're eating them or saving them, but where I live, where lobsters are plentiful, it could be either or both. It's also National One-Hit Wonder Day, so that's what you should put like on your music players. My guest today, Mark Scalzo, Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager at Validus Growth Investors, manager of the Destra Multi-Alternative Fund, DestraCapital.com and ValidusGrowth.com. Abhay Deshpande from Centerstone Investors, centerstoneinv.com. Tony Turner from Trendstar Group, tonyturner.com, Tony with an I, at Tony Turner Trade on Twitter. Charles Ropeblatt, the extra guest, editor of AAII Journal, AAII.com, and at Charles R. AAII. And Martin LeClaire, Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager at Barrick Yard Advisors, barrickyard.com, at Barrick Yard on Twitter. Thanks to them, and of course, thanks to Rob Floyd, my producer, but mostly thanks to you for being here. You make this special and worthwhile for me each and every day. The Money Life quote of the day today comes from Peter Walsh, who said, "Clutter is not just the stuff on your floor. It's anything that stands between you and the life you want to be living." Well, as somebody who's been cleaning up stuff on the floor and trying to get rid of clutter, I can't tell you enough how much it will be freeing. So spend your weekend maybe doing some of that. And while you're trying to remove the clutter, both real and mental and emotional, from your life, remember that until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is not worry too much about it. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you again on Monday.
The people who appear on Money Life are here for your and their own entertainment. Don't take advice from us or any other podcast without doing more research and or consulting your financial advisor. We believe our guests provide reliable information, but we can't and don't guarantee the accuracy or completeness of their statements. Opinions expressed on Money Life are those of the host and guests only and reflect their personal thinking. They're not representative policy or strategy of any employers or sponsors. This show is produced by Money Life Radio, which retains all rights to the content. If you want to use any part of this show for your own purposes, be they good or evil, you must get our written permission first. And remember, with great financial information comes great responsibility. Please act responsibly.
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines.